the business on RTE Radio 1 with Bank of Ireland. As Ireland's enterprise bank, we're lending to over 500 businesses and farmers every week. The business on RTE Radio 1 with Bank of Ireland. As Ireland's enterprise bank, we're lending to over 500 businesses and farmers every week.
Good morning. Today's show is all about entertainment. We have legends of the Irish music industry, Donal Lunny and Andy Irvine. Four-time Academy Award nominee Jim Sheridan is also here with us. A songwriter who has written hits for Britney Spears and One Direction. And another songwriter who's recently been number one in the charts in not one or two or three European countries, but eight. Not bad going. We'll also hear about the lives of ballerinas, so it's a full show. You can contact us by text to 51551, by phone to 1850715150, email thebusiness@rte.ie or tweet to @thebusinessRTE. Well, as I mentioned there in the intro, it's all about entertainment, and I'm joined beside me here by Jim Sheridan. Jim, obviously a lot of Academy Award nominations, a lot of Academy Award wins as well for films that you've done. What are you working on right now?
I'm working on The Secret Scripture by Sebastian Barry, you know, doing an adaptation of that. We've got a great cast. Vanessa Redgrave and Rooney Mara. And the Irish actor Jack Rayner, who plays a pilot in it.
What's it about?
It's about a woman who's committed to a mental asylum in Ireland in the, I don't know when, before the war, during the war. Second World War, I've said it, you know. And mostly it's about that. It's about just the conflict between the male and female, you know.
How far on is the production?
We start in about 2 weeks. I just have Christmas break. But it's really, really difficult to put an independent movie together. Where it used to be one studio giving the money, there's about 12 moving parts. And you have to get them all together with their lawyers, and each has two lawyers.
So you end up doing a hell of a lot more work, basically. Instead of having a studio say, here you go, off you go and make the film, you've got to put more of those parts together.
Yeah, I believe that the studios are, you know, actively discouraging dramatic movies, you know. I think, like, I wouldn't say it's like a conspiracy, but I think that they realized about 7 or 8 years ago that they would migrate drama to TV, because now they can own world TV on the internet through Netflix streaming, you know. And now you see like HBO, and everybody talks about the golden age of television, and a lot of it's very good, but it's just because there's a policy to put talk on the TV and put action on the screen for China and India. So essentially the American studio system is making big movies for foreign countries and eroding its own base day by day.
So you think that that's very actively a deliberate carve-up that they're doing?
It doesn't work like that.
Or is it just evolving that way?
It's the way any capitalist or enterprise goes, you know. If you can increase the cost of making the product, you eliminate competition if you've got the biggest market. And seeing that there's 250 million people in America, they've got the biggest market. So they kept increasing the cost of doing productions. Like, The Boxer cost 40 million. You wouldn't get four for it today. So how did it cost 40 million back then? You know what I mean? It's like, how did they increase it that high? Now, maybe there was people willing to pay at the other end, so they were making a fortune. But they weren't telling anybody.
So you also then have to tailor what you do into that market, the reality of all of that, because you have to then know what the audience wants, and it becomes more formulaic then.
Yeah, it might become more formulaic. You're operating within a certain constraint. It depends on which box office you want to make. You know, I think if you want to make, there's limits. They're kind of invisible to most people because they're not involved in the business. But like a normal Woody Allen movie would make about 20 million just because of what it is. And a Scorsese movie used to make, when he was doing like family Italian movies or gangster ones, there was a ceiling on them of about 60, 70 million. It wasn't until he started doing other things that wasn't his genre, you know, that he made more. So, but the movie that's the Clint Eastwood movie, Make My Day, has unlimited potential, like 200 million. And now they're only making that. They're making superheroes who are making decisions to save the world. They're making, it looks to me like Republican movies, like Red State movies, all the time, all day.
Doesn't sound like you're enjoying that, Jim.
No, is anybody enjoying it?
Yeah. You have, Donal and Andy have your own connections with the acting and the film world as well. Andy, you actually started off as an actor long before you were a musician.
Yes, I did. I was a child actor. My mother was a musical comedy actress, and my sister was an actress. And my sister smuggled some photographs of me to an agency in London. And suddenly I was in a movie called A Tale of Five Cities with long-forgotten people like Bonner Calino. And,
do you want to be in Secret Scripture?
Huh?
I'd give you a part in Secret Scripture.
Okay.
No, I'm serious.
Well, I'm not sure. You know, I gave up acting when I hit the age of kind of hormone change and suddenly didn't know what to do with my hands. A typical thing, you know. There's very few child actors who make it into the juvenile stage.
That's a pretty good offer, though. Jim sounds like he
well,
might write
yes,
a part especially
for
you.
I might have a word with him afterwards. <all right. laughs>
Well, what changed then? What drew you to music? Because you were in the acting scene in Dublin. You were in Talca Row, the television
I was,
television
I was,
series.
Yes. God help me, I was. And
What part did you play in that?
I played a character called Jim Toomey, I think was his name, and he had a beard. So he was called Beardy in those days. And I was playing opposite, Laurie Morton was my girlfriend. Yeah. And I'm not sure now, I don't know how old she was, but she was definitely 15 years older than I was.
But at some point you decided.
And I looked about 10 anyway.
She's still a good looker, Larry Moore.
Is she?
Yeah,
oh, good. Lovely. I haven't seen her since then.
There you go. Jim knows everybody. So you decided at some point, Andy, then, that it was going to be music. You had enough of acting.
Well, I wasn't very good. And I lost more and more confidence, you know. And I used to go into Neary's, where you might hear about...
pub just off Grafton
yeah,
Street.
Yeah, you know, it was like a kind of casting couch. And there was a lot of the people who were in Neary's in those days were awful backbiting bunch of typical kind of theatrical horrors. Like, and one day somebody said, "Oh, this is an awful place." Somebody who wasn't an actor, so come on, we go down Merrion Row and go to O'Donoghue's. And as soon as I spent about 10 minutes in O'Donoghue's, I thought, this is it. This is where I want to be. And I'd been playing music, so I was kind of well-equipped.
You thought, I'm never going to leave this place.
I never did for about 6 years.
And that was in the early 60s?
Yeah.
What about you, Donal? You never did any acting, I don't think. Did you act? You know?
I was auditioned all right, along with the rest of the country, for a part in Commitments. But that was the height of it, yeah.
No regrets about that. How did that go? What sort of a part was it?
Not at all. I think it was the manager. The part that Johnny Murphy eventually played.
It was an interesting character. You've written soundtracks and film
yes,
scores.
This is true, yeah.
For television, but also then for films, including Eat the Peach, I remember
Eat the
very
Peach,
well.
Yeah, that was the first kind of major feature, homegrown here, and it was a great thing to be involved in.
One of the things, Jim, you were talking there about how the industry, the film industry, is evolving globally, and the power of America and the American audiences and the American studios. How important then is it, if you're going to make an Irish film, you continue to make mm-hmm. Irish films about Irish stories. So how do you factor in that the potential audiences into what goes into the film?
It's a bit like playing hurling with a baseball bat, you know. It's kind of hard, you know. It's because so many assumptions that we make in Ireland don't really work for the American audience, you know. And if you don't exist within the American distribution system, you don't exist as a movie. Like Once came out here, and I don't know how much it did, not much. Then it went to America, and it made 15 million, came back. It was a huge hit in Ireland. Same with The Crying Game. Crying Game came out, did very little, went to America, did 70 million, came back and did 20 million.
So is that the Irish audience's fault rather than those making the films?
People think if it comes out and it's an Irish movie, it's just a little Irish movie, it must be crap. We didn't hear of it in America. We didn't hear of it through the normal channels, which is RTE. So you get the RTE front page and it's all about American movies. It would rarely be about an Irish movie. And it would only be about an Irish movie if the Irish movie had been a hit in the States. So you don't actually exist. You're invisible unless you're seen within that structure.
One of the things that does seem to change as I watch more and more films, and I enjoy a big mm-hmm. hit film, a big mm-hmm. budget film, you know, a Planet of the Apes or a visual spectacle or whatever. But when I watch films, and I was watching My Left Foot recently, mm-hmm. and I've seen the film maybe mm-hmm. 7 or 8 times, mm-hmm. and I watched it again, it was the first time in a few years, and it's such a fantastic story, and the pathos in it, and the humanity, and the subtlety, and the nuance in it. And I wondered as I watched it, would you make that film today? And if you made it exactly as you had, the very same mm-hmm. film, would it win Oscars?
I don't know. It might be much harder to get made. It would be much, much harder to get made. That movie is an example of a structure that's... When Richard Harris was going to direct it, and he met me in the hotel that is... Uncle used to run beside Jury's, and he had a big suite up there, and he was a character, and he was like, Jim, you got to start with the Bert. There's no such thing as flashbacks in movies anymore. And I was like, I can't do that, Richard. And he's like, why not? How much are you getting paid in the Irish Art Centre? I was like, $200 a week. He's like, well, you're getting $5,000. Shut up and do it. And I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it, and I didn't know why. And then I saw a movie the year before My Left Foot, like I was supposed to come back and do a rewrite, and it had this movie called Gabby. So it said, a girl is born with cerebral palsy, can only move her left foot, goes on to be the most famous poet, Gabriel Brimmer, in Mexico, and it's all about her love life. And I was like, well, they made the movie already. So I went down to 13th Street where it was on in a art house cinema, and the movie started, and it started, Liv Ullmann had starred. And Liv Ullmann, the mother, comes in. The doctor says, you know, your daughter can only move her left foot. And I just felt like the hair in the back of my neck go up, because I realized only when I was in the crowd, like in other words, with other people, why I didn't want to do it that way. And it was that the entire audience saw a picture the minute they said that, of that child walking. So if that child wasn't going to walk, it was going to disappoint the audience no matter what you did. So when we started with him older, 28, the audience immediately went, oh, so he's disabled, he can only move his left foot, he's not going to get better, so what's it about? Oh, it's an emotional story, just like us. He's the same as us. Whereas if you'd separated the person as disabled at the beginning, the audience demand that they become able-bodied, I think, or they're pushed out of the story.
They would have wanted a different ending.
They can't find access into the story. You know, yeah. It depends where you start. Like, I'd give the same example about 1916. If you started with the taking over to the GPO, it'd be totally insane.
Why?
Because the audience would go, oh, they take over the fort and fighting the English, who are fighting the Germans. Oh, hold on, whose side are we on? So they're immediately conflicted. They think the Germans have always been the baddies, and there's only one war, and that was the Hitler war. So they're confused. And then we fight for a few weeks, and we kill people. And then we shoot the lancers and the horses under them, and then we surrender with a white flag, and then we're afforded a trial. We didn't afford anybody.
So what would you start with that, Jim? 1916.
I just started with them hanging everybody. Just hang seven guys one day after the other, you know?
Well, that'd certainly get their attention.
The other way, you're going into the marriage at the point at which the wife hits the husband who's been abusing her for 50 years in the back of the head with a frying pan. Sure. It's not a good place to start.
Yes, yeah. Well, in Jim's business, Andy, clearly and increasingly you have to factor in your audience and your target audience and what you want. I presume for you guys that was never something that you particularly thought about. It was about the music and wherever it took you. Or is that a naive take on it?
Well, no, I think that's more or less correct. Mm. Like, you know, I mean, I'm fascinated by Jim telling these stories because I would have no clue about directing a movie and where to start and how the audience would feel if you started in the wrong place. I think that's really, really interesting.
How do you cater for your audience? Or do you just say, here I am?
Well, you know, I think I've been really lucky about... 40 years ago, Planxty was very much the making of somebody like me. And I was left with an audience after Planxty broke up. And I've hung on to that audience and added to it over the years. And so they don't expect me to do anything that I don't want to do. I just do what I do. They remain with me. So.
But that audience is a very international audience. I mean, you still tour a lot, and you'll go around Europe, you'll go to South America,
yeah.
Japan.
Yeah.
They clearly have grown and evolved with that. I mean, is it therefore important, and this is one of the big debates in the whole music industry around recording now and whether or not recording albums is profitable and whether people are more dependent on touring. Do you think that, you need to keep recording to have more material to deliver to that audience, or is it just out there and it endures itself?
No, I think it's important to keep recording for one's own peace of mind. You know, I mean, if you play a great gig, you think, wow, that was a great gig, but it's gone, it's gone into the ether. Whereas if you make an album, you can listen to it all the time. I was listening to the last album we made in the car, and I thought, it's bloody great. So, I mean,
you were listening to it in the car. You didn't make it in the car, I presume.
Yes.
There's an album of Andy's 70th birthday bash in Vicar Street.
Right.
With loads of guests and that. Yeah, it was very good. Yeah.
And what about you, Donald? I mean, again, touring is a massive part of what you do, but the whole music industry is changing now. That in terms of making an income,
yes,
surprisingly, I don't think people saw it going this way. Mm. Musicians are relying more and more on touring instead of their album output.
Yeah, the whole ground has changed. It has shifted, and it's because basically record companies can't sell records anymore or CDs. They've become passé. So everybody's downloading and streaming and whatever else. Sort of source of income has vanished. And publishing is no longer fit for purpose because it can't be controlled. So a lot of people who write music and that, you know, aren't making the same kind of income out of it as they used to.
So where does that leave you then? I mean, do you go ahead and continue to record new material because it will support the touring, which is a much tougher way to make money?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, I don't know, it's not making albums is not entirely about money. It's also about sort of, if you like, progressing your repertoire and keeping moving and keeping musically alive. So it's a great way to sort of move things along. As well as that, though, you can sell a certain number of CDs on gigs and stuff, you know. But I haven't seen a recording contract for a good few years now because I haven't gone that way. But funny enough, I was in a conversation last night and somebody mentioned the 360-degree contract, which is that record companies now want an interest in all your sources of income. So they want to slice, you know, so they'll finance a recording, but they want a slice of your concert income. and merchandise, whatever that is. If you're selling T-shirts, whatever. So it's become a kind of, you know, I mean, record companies are actually loan companies in a way, you know. No.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, I don't know if you two guys have ever busked. I'm sure you must have, but you probably don't need to or haven't needed to for a long time.
Well, that's that for me now, that'd be just further diversification, really, you know. That's how I've survived so far. I mean, I went into a lot of different areas of music, you know, like production and writing for movies or TV things or whatever, you know. So
keeping as many different irons in the fire. Well, this is it. Just to remind you, perhaps, of your busking days, for many aspiring musicians, the first step on the ladder to success is often a lonely couple of feet on a crowded Grafton street. So we sent reporter Julian Clancy out to hear what life is like for the men and women for whom peak season coincides with the worst working conditions.
Mm-hmm. There's nothing about the sound of somebody singing and playing a guitar. They just bring the street alive. You know, otherwise it's just silence and mobile phones and security guards' radios. You don't want to be hearing that all day. You want to hear some music, it cheers you up.
As a Galilean boy, he wondered what it meant.
Personally, for me, when you get a song that, you know, you see that somebody be walking and they'll be concentrating on going and walking down the street, and then they'll hear it, they'll stop and the head will come up, and you know they've listened, and it's what grabs you. You have to love what you do. If you don't love what you do, you may as well just stay in bed. You know?
Who puts the rainbow in the sky?
I came up to Dublin in 1985 when my girls were going to primary school, and they're all working here in Dublin now. So something to do while they were at school and be self-employed at the same time, so I tried it. And when you get used to sitting outdoors, the air, you're not confined by four walls. I think I got hooked on that.
Have Dublin people, have they been generous to you over the years?
They're very good. They are. Bring you a cup of tea and sandwiches and everything. It used to be £15 from ages and ages, and then the old euro came in. And then it became €15 and all. And it's gone down because people have other priorities with their money.
Yeah. Why do you stay out here then playing music?
That's my living, and I don't want to retire, so it's independence, getting your own money without being independent on the state. And because it's so important to play the music of the country here, because it's rare, don't you know? Have you seen any other trad players here?
To be honest, I try and busk like in different cities and stuff, you know. I try and move around to Dublin, like other times Galway, and you know, I love coming out here because, you know, Cork people are happy as well, like, so.
And it all happened in a dream. I didn't know if it was real or not.
The only reason it's challenging, you know, is because, you know, sometimes it's dangerous. Like, sometimes there are some people who try and rob you, like, but you gotta, like, stand your ground and just not give them anything, because, like, if they see that you're afraid, like, they'll just walk all over you. And, like, if a, like, person walk past you and try to get a €2, if you give them that, then we'll say the next day they might come back again, like, so just gotta make sure that you're not led into that stuff.
By the land of the Congos is where we were mates for years, but the only problem is that she lives far away.
I'm happy with whatever. If anyone even if someone throws you 10 cents, that could mean €2 to them, like, so, you know, I don't mind what they throw. I just like going out and leaving people hear my music, even my original songs, and if they throw money, they throw money, or even if they come up to me and just tell me that was a good song, most of it is just the love of music for me, you know.
Julian Clancy reporting there. It reminds me of seeing a guy on stage one time, and at the end of singing his songs, he said, "Thanks for listening," and someone shouted, "It wasn't easy." But it can be tough. Jim, we were talking there just a bit about how the industry changed. What's your own take on the music industry? I mean, I know you made the film about 50 Cent as well, so you're very familiar with the rap part of the business.
Yeah. That's a different world, you know, the rap. It's like, it's actually, I know a guy who started NWA, Jerry Heller, you know, he was actually Van Morrison's manager, tells good stories about Van. And he said to me that Sgt. Pepper's was the worst thing that ever happened to music. And he had this whole idea that it cost so much to make it that it put music in the totally wrong direction. But the mixtapes, like the guys who were doing rap were doing vinyl. They were pressing vinyl in, like, what, 90s? In these, like, factories in L.A., you could smell the vinyl, Jerry went in. So the industry had moved on, but they were going backwards. And every advance in technology is a dumbing down artistically. So, like, first thing I noticed was when we got the tape for the videotape and the, you know, you used to have college film societies, they'd show Truffaut and Fellini and Bergman. And then everybody said, but I can get it on tape. No, but you can't because the subtitles are too small to see on tape. So everybody stopped watching foreign movies because of the videotape. And now you can't get nobody would go to a subtitled movie in America where everybody used to go. So the advances are like, the artists, it's kind of
backwards.
Like, they're sometimes a step backwards on certain levels. Mm-hmm. You know, like I was saying, I believe Steve Jobs was a thief. And I think it still is. I think the whole stealing of these people's lives and music is robbery.
But was he not saying with Apple that he was going to be the first guy that was going to come up with a system where artists could get paid? It might not have worked the way it was intended.
Yeah, 2 cents. 2 cents instead of, like, RTE. Explain to me why RTE has to pay Donal and Andy X amount, like, say, a euro a play, but Spotify on the internet pays them half a cent. Explain it. One has an audience of 500 million and the other has 3 million, but one pays 100 times more than the audience with 500 million. Explain that. How does that work?
I think it's called sharp business, probably.
Like, okay, explain Netflix to me in comparison to RTE. RTE is not allowed. I'm not allowed to see a Gaelic game in America without paying a lot. You're not even allowed to get it when you go there on RTE. But if I come here, I can see Netflix every day of the week. How do you explain that?
It's the culture of capitalism, contemporary capitalism, which is, if I can get away with it, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And it applies right across the board. It's 0 hours contracts. Yeah. It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
If I can do that, if I can employ people without giving them anything, except the basic, well, I'll do it.
No, I agree with that. It's like standing there in your underpants and they're saying... Yeah. But you still have your underpants.
Yeah. Okay, on that graphic image, we'll move swiftly on and we'll be back after this ad break.